From NPR West, you're listening to the podcast edition of All Things Considered, the best picks from our programs on Saturday and Sunday. I'm Tess Vigeland, in for Arun Roth. This episode, 10 years ago, Massachusetts became the first state to conduct same-sex marriages and sent one couple into the history books.
Oh my God. Totally excited. Never thought that we would ever see this in our lifetime.
War veterans wonder who is fighting for them as a new scandal envelops the VA.
The next question shouldn't be, should the secretary lose his job? It should be, has there been criminal negligence?
Plus, there's a new Godzilla in theaters. How'd they make this sound?
We actually were sworn to take it to our graves with us.
And actor Terry Crews stops by with second thoughts about his new memoir.
The book should have been called, you know, Terry Crews is an Idiot, and this is how I survived. I'm serious.
That's all on this episode of All Things Considered from NPR West. Ten years ago, on May 17th, 2004, gay marriage became a reality in Massachusetts.
Just after midnight, thousands celebrated what was once just a dream.
Since then, 16 more states and the District of Columbia have legalized same-sex marriage, and more than 70,000 same-sex couples have tied the knot. That's according to the Pew Research Center. That's our cover story today, a decade of gay marriage. In November of 2003, the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court ruled in Goodridge versus the Department of Public Health that the state's ban on same-sex marriage was unconstitutional. Among those waiting intently for the decision was a lesbian couple in Malden.
Hi, this is Marcia Kadish.
And this is Tanya McCloskey.
Tanya McCloskey couldn't believe her ears when she heard the news.
Oh my God, totally excited. Never thought that we would ever see this in our lifetime. We've always felt like we were married, but to actually be legal, that we could actually get married, is just really incredible.
But the court gave the state legislature 6 months to respond, to enact new laws that could potentially change the ruling. So McCloskey and Kadish went about their lives. They didn't plan a wedding. In fact, neither even proposed. They'd been together for 18 years and weren't focused on a piece of paper somehow legitimizing their relationship. That's not to say they didn't want one. 6 months later, after several rounds of failed political effort, same-sex marriage came to Massachusetts. McCloskey and Kadish, along with many, many others, went to the courthouse at midnight, May 17th.
We were getting roses and love, and everybody was still there screaming, kiss, 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 and
yeah,
clapping.
Everybody that came out.
It was just fabulous.
They didn't leave until 2 in the morning. 4 hours later.
Remember how I woke you up?
You said, come on, honey, let's make history. And we did. We didn't know we were going to do that.
So
we went to the courthouse, and nobody was there. It was totally abandoned, and it was like...
Everybody slept in. I don't know. Yeah. It was like, were we at the right place? We didn't know. It was like, oh, well.
Tanya went to get breakfast sandwiches, and by the time she came back with the sandwiches, the line started to form.
Yeah.
We were the first in line.
There was a TV crew. There was people there. I was like, oh, my God.
And the crew said, asked if they could film us. We said, sure. Why not?
Absolutely.
So we went into the courthouse, we got our waiver, and then we got in the car and went to Cambridge City Hall. Mm-hmm. You know, we were the first, and we were just so excited, and I just planted a big kiss on my honey.
Oh my God, she lip-locked me, right?
Like, I had totally forgot that the cameras were on. And then later when we looked on our 57-inch screen and I saw me lip-locking Tanya, I wanted to die.
Oh my
I was
God.
So embarrassed.
Marcia Kadish and Tanya McCloskey say they don't really feel the weight of history on their marriage, despite being one of a number of firsts on that day. They're just what they've always been, a corporate recruiter and a massage therapist. But as barriers to same-sex marriage continue to fall in states across the country, that day has proved a watershed. A recent Washington Post ABC News poll showed 59% of the population now supports same-sex marriage. And corporate America has taken notice.
And while what it means to be a family hasn't changed, what a family looks like has.
This Chevy ad that aired during this year's Olympics featured montages of people and families that included gay couples with children. Coke had similar storylines in a Super Bowl ad. It's hard to argue that those depictions are now the norm. It's still notable when a major brand releases a gay-friendly commercial. But it is a long way from where it was 20 years ago. IKEA released this commercial in March of 1994.
Well, you know, we went to IKEA because we thought it was time for a serious dining room table.
Just two guys, clearly a couple, talking about their new furniture.
This table concluded a leaf.
A leaf means staying together, commitment. We've got another leaf waiting when we really start getting along.
It was reported to be the very first ad featuring a gay couple to air on mainstream television. A week after its premiere, the fallout included protesters, jammed phone lines, and a bomb scare at a New York store. That commercial was unusual because at the time, if they advertised to the gay community at all, corporations focused on an LGBT-only audience, ads in a gay magazine, or sponsoring an LGBT event. David Paisley has been doing market research on this subject for nearly 20 years.
Now, that in some ways can be a little bit safer because you can target the communities. You know, nobody in San Francisco is going to bat an eye at a same-sex couple on a bus shelter poster. But if you did that in Wichita, it might be a different story, right?
Paisley says in the early 90s, the company's only clients were the travel and alcohol industries. Then a major publication ran an article about the purchasing power of the gay population.
The Wall Street Journal recognized the LGBT community as a niche segment that could be very profitable for corporations. And when that article was written, it was very groundbreaking.
Paisley is quick to also credit gay employees within those corporations for pushing issues of equality. But the bottom line is the bottom line.
All corporations, their main function is to make profit. And the LGBT community represents about 5% of American adults.
Alienating 5% of your potential customer base isn't a sound business strategy. American Airlines learned that the hard way. In 1993, a man with advanced AIDS boarded a flight at O'Hare. Before the flight took off, he started an IV drip, which was then against airline policy. A flight attendant asked him to put the drip away and to cover up open lesions on his face. When he refused, four policemen were called on board to arrest him. The man sued. American revamped its training policies, but the damage to the brand was done.
There was actually a boycott from the LGBT community against American over this. But what American did was they called leaders into their office, they listened, and they decided that, in fact, what happened was wrong and that they should have an outreach approach to change their image in the LGBT community. So in many ways, they were the first major corporation to really have a very specific and targeted approach.
The airline started offering special fares out of San Francisco and sponsoring LGBT events. And in 1994, the company added a sexual orientation non-discrimination clause to its bylaws.
They were wildly successful, and they really became the airline of choice for the gay and lesbian community.
20 years hence, and 10 years after Massachusetts, some major corporations like Starbucks are now signing on to, and even raising money for, state ballot initiatives in favor of same-sex marriage. Others have found themselves embroiled in controversy over the issue. And corporate America isn't the only place that's happening. Some Christian denominations around the U.S. have been slowly warming to the idea of gay marriage, but not the country's largest Protestant group. The Southern Baptist Convention still preaches that marriage is only one man and one woman. But as Blake Farmer of member station WPLN in Nashville reports, some pastors are softening what they say.
Address the sinfulness and the harmful consequences of divorce.
The Southern Baptist Convention held a gathering of pastors at its Nashville headquarters in April for an organization that has previously used opposition to gay marriage as a rallying point. Statements here from church leaders like Kevin Smith of Kentucky shocked the auditorium of pastors into silence.
If you spent 20 years and you've never said anything about divorce in the church culture, then shut up about gay marriage.
Pastor Jimmy Scroggins of Florida went even further.
We're all in agreement that the cultural war is over when it comes to homosexuality, especially when it comes to gay marriage.
Officially, Southern Baptists aren't backing down from their belief that homosexuality is sinful. Gays and lesbians are still barred from church membership without repenting first. But Scroggins says they're sitting in the pews and shouldn't be the butt of preacher humor. He calls that redneck theology.
Let's stop telling Adam and Steve jokes and let's be compassionate because these are people that are in our community, these are people that are in our churches.
Baptist voices in the recent past were not known for compassion on gay issues. Richard Land was the church's chief spokesman for 25 years, and while no longer speaking for the denomination, he can still be heard from time to time on Christian talk radio, saying things like this.
I know that the dirty little secret that nobody wants to talk about is that a high percentage of adult male homosexuals in America were sexually molested when they were children.
In recent months, the provocative former Baptist official also called gay activists a lynch mob. He declined to be interviewed for this story. The man chosen to replace Land, Russell Moore, is trying to rein in the flame-throwing.
When I hear people who are simply screaming in outrage right now, let me tell you what I hear. I hear losers.
Moore says instead of waging war on homosexuality, Baptists should accept that their view of marriage puts them in the minority of Americans.
We're living in a different time where we have to learn how to understand what's going on in the world around us.
Justin Lee of Raleigh, North Carolina, had to leave the church and sees openly gay. He now leads the Gay Christian Network and applauds what he's hearing from Baptist leaders.
I think it's a wonderful step forward. I don't think that it is where we want to end up.
Lee says he wouldn't expect Baptists to suddenly change the way they've always read the Bible on homosexuality. Still, what Lee sees as progress, religious conservatives view as backsliding. Radio host Janet Mefford of Dallas has taken to the airwaves on her syndicated talk show.
You see more pastors caving and muddling and getting more and more mealy-mouthed about the issue.
Outside of evangelical churches, this toning down the rhetoric on gay issues sounds a little less dramatic. Emily Towns is dean of Vanderbilt University's Divinity School. She's also gay.
If the only thing you're saying is, let's not be so harsh, then the attitude that's still behind it of judging and unacceptance and damnation will still come out, and people will feel it and respond to it.
Towns figures the underlying position on gay issues is one reason for the ongoing slide in Southern Baptist membership. Until the change is more than talk, she says the denomination will continue to drive gay people away. For NPR News, I'm Blake Farmer in Nashville.
This past week, Eric Shinseki, Secretary of the Department of Veterans Affairs, testified before the Senate, and he got grilled. Whistleblowers from the VA hospital in Phoenix, Arizona, have alleged that veterans were waiting months for appointments and that administrators may have faked hospital records to keep those egregious wait times secret. There are further allegations that dozens of veterans may have died waiting for care. Secretary Shinseki told Congress he is, quote, mad as hell about all this, but he's also waiting for the results of an official investigation. Tom Tarantino was at last week's hearing and says Shinseki isn't mad as hell enough. Tarantino is the chief policy officer with the Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America, and he is himself a former Army captain. I asked him whether the secretary should lose his job over the scandal.
If these allegations are true and veterans lost their life waiting for care, the next question shouldn't be, should the secretary lose his job? It should be, has there been criminal negligence? In terms of the secretary losing his job, the question that we are not quite ready to answer is losing the secretary, the current secretary, going to help or actually hurt the problem?
Were you satisfied with his testimony this week before the Senate Committee on Veterans Affairs? What were you hoping to hear?
Well, we were hoping that he would come out strongly emotionally, that he would be very well versed on what is happening and actually show the veterans of this country that people will be held accountable. And we didn't see that. He looked unprepared. He did not emote the type of confidence that we need to see from someone who is, for lack of a better term, the chief veteran of the United States. It's been a problem with his tenure since he took over. Secretary Shinseki has been largely invisible to the American people, and he runs the only government agency that is public-facing. He runs a healthcare system of 8 million people.
Your organization, the IAVA, has been asking veterans to report fraud, mismanagement, abuse at the VA at a website that you set up. What are you expecting to hear there, and what have you already heard from veterans?
We have heard from our members that there has been long wait times at VA hospitals for years. It's actually been going on for decades. And we have been hearing these anecdotes for a long time, but we were never able to prove it because the VA has been reporting that everyone gets seen in 2 weeks. It's only because of brave men and women, many of which are veterans themselves, who work at the VA, who care about the mission, are coming forward and exposing this mismanagement at the VA hospitals. And so we teamed up with the Project on Government Oversight to give them a safe way to do that, and that's vaoversight.org. And you have a way to safely report so that you're protected and that the information that you report gets vetted and the appropriate action can be taken.
You know, service members aren't always the first people to, you know, raise their hands and say, I need help. How difficult is it for them to report on this sort of thing?
It's difficult. And when they see the VA pulling these types of shenanigans, it's even harder. Our biggest fear is that there are veterans out there who are not going to seek help because they lose faith and they lose trust in the VA.
Tom, do you use VA services yourself?
I actually do, and I get great VA healthcare. I live within walking distance of the VA hospital, and I use it all the time. And this is, you know, I think my experience is reflective of what a lot of members are experiencing, that getting to the VA is a hassle, dealing with the VA is a hassle. But once you actually get in, their care is quite good. So there's a lot of good stuff at the VA. We just have to make sure that the bad is taken care of. It's taken care of swiftly and efficiently, and nobody is in danger because of it.
That's Tom Tarantino. He is the Chief Policy Officer with the Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America. He also served in Iraq with the U.S. Army. Tom, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Since I spoke with Tom Tarantino, the Undersecretary for Health at the Department of Veterans Affairs, Robert Petzl, resigned. Though we should also note, Petzl already had plans to retire. A few years ago, citrus trees in Florida just started dying. A disease called citrus greening spread all over the state, wiping out thousands of acres and devastating farmers. The major culprit was a tiny bug called the Asian citrus psyllid that carried the disease from tree to tree. Well, that same bug recently started showing up here in California, where citrus is a $2 billion industry. Farmers are worried that what happened in Florida might happen again. So they're working with scientists to kill off the bug before it's too late. And the solution isn't necessarily pesticides. The answer to this problem may be another bug. Stephen Jackson has that story.
I'm getting the grand tour of Associates and Sectary in Santa Paula, California. It's basically a bug farm.
I'll take you to where the wasps are being collected now, and the wasps are raised.
That's Brett Chandler. He's the owner. They raise beetles, snails, mites, and wasps. Bugs that do so many good things for farmers, they're called beneficials. In the wasp room, Chandler hands me a little cup, the kind you might get cream cheese in at a deli. This one is full of baby wasps, no bigger than grains of salt.
I'm guessing in this cup, by what I see here, is about 40,000. And we'll collect 50, maybe 100 cups on a good day.
Associates is one of the oldest insectaries in the world. It's been around since the early 1900s, when California farmers first realized they could use bugs to fight pests. Today, we have more and better pesticides than we did back then, but plenty of farmers still use bugs, too. Farmers like Jose Alcaraz. He manages 250 acres of citrus and avocados just down the road.
I don't want to spray too much because also you kill the beneficials. It also kill bees, also kill the insect, which is used for pollinators. So that's why we try to stay away from the spray.
But when it comes to this new pest, the Asian citrus psyllid, Alcaraz will have to spray because there's no bug on the market to fight it. That's where Mark Hoddle comes in. He's an entomologist at the University of California, Riverside. He travels the world looking for bugs. He went to Pakistan, where the psyllid comes from, and he found something big. Well, actually pretty small. It's a parasitic wasp, and it loves to eat the psyllid. So he brought a few back and started running tests to make sure they wouldn't kill other bugs, good bugs, if they came to California.
And our results were very clear. The parasites we found in Pakistan pose no risk to non-target species. They are very focused on finding Asian citrus psyllid for food.
You kind of have to wonder, wouldn't a simple spray be much easier than this? Why go to all the trouble? The answer is surprising. California has more citrus trees in people's yards than on farms. For those trees, pesticides aren't an option because they're not safe to use around lots of people. Besides, it would cost a fortune to spray every tree. And if any of those residential trees were to get citrus greening disease, all it would take would be one psyllid to carry it onto farmland, which would be very bad news.
We don't want the psyllid getting into these commercial areas because it runs the risk of introducing the disease, which will then put us on a similar trajectory to what we have seen in Florida.
That's why Mark Hoddle's wasp is so important. And he's not the only one who feels that way. The California Department of Food and Agriculture has an insectary working full-time, hatching wasps and releasing them strategically around the state. They're hoping to release 1 million by the end of the year, a big step forward in protecting California farms. For NPR News, I'm Stephen Jackson.
Some futurists have predicted that one day we will no longer read books, at least not physical books. Lots of us have already made that transition to e-books, read on Kindles and iPads and other tablets. But here's a book that will never have an electronic version. That would defeat the purpose.
Introducing the Drinkable Book, the first ever tool that teaches safe water habits and is printed on technologically advanced filter paper capable of killing deadly waterborne diseases.
That's a clip from a promotional video by Water is Life, the nonprofit behind a drinkable book. From the outside, it looks a lot like your average book, an inch or two thick with 20 pages. But each page serves as two water filters. Teresa Dankovich is the chemist who developed the filter paper.
The filters are basically thick sheets of paper that contain silver nanoparticles, and silver is a very toxic metal for microbes, but not for humans. There's very little effect on humans from silver. So essentially, the microbes come in contact with silver in the paper, and as a result, they are killed by the interaction, and then the water is clean for us to drink.
The book itself works in three easy steps. Simply tear out a filter, slide it into the custom filter box, and pour contaminated water through.
It removes 99.9% of bacteria in drinking water, making the end product comparable to U.S. tap water. Dankovich has been working on the paper for years. The book came together when an ad agency got wind of the technology. That agency, DDB, introduced Dankovich to the nonprofit Water is Life, and the drinkable book was born.
A lot of water issues aren't just because people don't have the right technology, but because they aren't informed why they need to treat water to begin with. So I really like the educational component, and it's just very nice to store it in a book.
Each book has tips about water safety, printed in non-toxic ink. Wash your hands before eating. Keep trash away from your water source. It will be printed in English and local languages.
Our main goal is to reduce the spread of diarrheal diseases, which result from drinking water that's been contaminated with things like E. coli and cholera and typhoid. And these diseases cause the death of 3.4 million people every year in developing countries. So it's a big deal, and we think that we can help prevent some of these illnesses from even happening.
Each filter costs about 10 cents to make and can last a couple of weeks, even up to a month. So one book potentially provides tools to filter water for about a year. Dankovich is hoping to make it a staple in places without access to clean water.
That will take a lot of work, but I feel like we have a good shot.
Dankovich tested the paper in South Africa last year. This fall, she'll take the drinkable books to Ghana to get a read on how they work. Hear that? 60 years ago, in pitch-black theaters, that sound creeped out Japanese moviegoers as the opening credits rolled and people first heard the approach of Godzilla.
I think that the Godzilla roar actually probably tops the King Kong roar in terms of iconicness.
It leaves a big footprint.
Yeah, pun intended there. That was Ethan van der Rijn and Eric Adahl. They are the sound designers for the new Godzilla movie, which is out right now. Ethan and Eric stopped by our studios to talk about how they crafted the latest roar, but I asked first what went into that original Godzilla roar from 1954. Here's Eric.
In the 1954 original, the sound effects team tried unsuccessfully using animal sounds to create the roar of Godzilla, And actually it was Akira Ifukube, the music composer, who had the idea to use a musical instrument to create that classic shriek that we all know. And it was actually a double bass using a leather glove coated with pine tar rosin to create friction. And they'd rub it against the string of the double bass to create that sound.
Well, over the years, there have been a lot of Godzilla movies, and it turns out that they all have very different versions of that roar. Let's listen to a couple of those. Here is Godzilla Raids Again. This is from 1955. And there is Godzilla's Revenge from 1969. That definitely sounds like 1969 there,
yeah,
doesn't it?
I love it.
And here's Godzilla from 1998. All right, so you get the assignment to craft the new roar. Let's hear it first. What is that?
You know, it's funny. Gareth Edwards, the director, asked us that same question. You know, we started on the roar almost 3 years ago, and it took about 6 months to get to that point. And Gareth asked us straight up, okay, what is that? And we actually decided not to tell him until a little over a month ago when we had finished the film. Because it's kind of like a magic trick. If you show, okay, the card is right here in the sleeve, and I'm going to pull it out, and that's the trick, it kind of diffuses it. It ruins it. And I think more so than any other sound effect we've designed, we have a certain protectiveness over that sound. You know, it's when you're giving voice to something, you're giving it its soul. And if we tell everybody exactly how we did it, people will think of that when they hear the roar, and we want them to think about Godzilla.
Oh, come on, Ethan. Nobody's listening. Just whisper it in my ear.
Actually were sworn to take it to our graves with us. So, no lie by Thomas Tull, the head of Legendary.
But we can talk about, you know, our process is very much experimentation. So we played a lot with anything that created friction. So we started with things like rusty car doors and, you know, the palm of our hand rubbing against a drum tom surface.
One of the things we did on Godzilla, which was unique for us, is that we recorded with a scientific microphone, which is able to record sounds outside the realm of human hearing. And then we brought them back into the studio and pitched them down into the realm of human hearing. And what that allowed us to do was exploit this vast universe of sounds that really people have never heard before.
So this is a dog whistle. That's what you're saying.
Maybe. Possibly.
You know, I've tried putting my dog into almost every movie I've done somewhere. That was one of the failed experiments.
Did you end up doing any of this, like, out where someone could figure out what you're doing?
Well, actually, it's an interesting story because we set up the Rolling Stones tour speaker array on the back lot of Warner Brothers where we were doing the work so that we could play back all these sounds that we had created and then re-record them, capturing all the reflections off the cityscape.
Did any of the neighbors call 911?
Yes.
Yes?
Well, yeah, the neighbors started tweeting, like, Godzilla's at my apartment door, and we were getting phone calls from Universal Studios across town because tour groups were asking, what's all that commotion going on down in the valley?
So, yeah, the sound that we were playing actually traveled over 3 miles.
3 miles?
Yeah.
Well, I guess that's what happens when you use Rolling Stones.
That's it. 100,000 watts of pure power.
Wow. That's Eric Adol and Ethan van der Rijn. They designed the sound for the new Godzilla movie, which is out now in theaters. Eric and Ethan, thanks so much.
Thank you.
This is a track from the new Michael Jackson album, Escape. Yes, new, released this week, nearly 5 years after his death. The album is comprised of music Jackson didn't finish. A team of hotshot producers was recruited to do the honors on behalf of one of the most famous pop stars of all time. We asked Ann Powers of NPR Music to give Escape a listen, and she joins us now. Welcome.
Thanks, Tess.
What'd you think?
Well, this is not a Michael Jackson record in the way that Thriller was, or even Bad. It's not history-making, but the songs on it are from throughout his career, and they have been reconstructed in such a way that they meld very nicely with his body of work. The themes of the songs, the sounds, and of course Michael's voice, which is still exquisite, are all appropriate, I'd say, I guess.
Yeah, you mentioned that this is from throughout his career, and you really do get a sense of his varying styles, you know, from really early on. I don't know, I kind of felt like the title track felt like it was from earlier in his career. Then you have songs like A Place With No Name that felt a little more recent.
Right. Well, A Place With No Name is, of course, based on the song by America, A Horse With No Name. And what's fun and interesting about that song is you can imagine Michael, who was 14 when the America song came out, growing up with it and then wanting to make it his own, as they say. And he does so brilliantly. I think that's one of the high points on the album. And in the fog, a woman appeared. She said, don't you worry, my friend. I'll take care, take my hand. I'll take it there. The producers, I think, were very sensitive. Timbaland, Rodney Jerkins, were very sensitive to the history of Michael Jackson, and that's really what this is in some ways. It's not a historical document, but it is enrichment of our sense of his history.
And what do we know about these discoveries? Were these just lying around in a studio somewhere?
Michael Jackson made many, many demos. He was always working. I think that's part of his tragedy, really. He worked himself to the end of his life. After he died, the Jackson Estate made a deal with Sony to recreate some of those demos as fresh music, and that's what we're hearing now. This was not the first. There was another album like this in 2010, and I have a feeling it won't be the last. But this is the most cohesive, I would say.
One of the most fascinating aspects of this release is that you can hear both what he did originally and then contrast that with what the producers did with the original material. You can get this on the deluxe version and also on Spotify. And, you know, the originals almost seem like pencil sketches rather than full portraits. Let's listen to a clip of Love Never Felt So Good. This is the produced version. Now let's listen to Michael Jackson's original version. This is the one he left behind. Oh, baby, love never felt so fine. And a dot above mine. And I'm curious, what, if anything, these originals tell you about the creative mind of MJ?
Well, I think they tell us a lot. And in fact, Tess, we've had other raw tracks from Michael Jackson surfacing in recent years. You can hear pure vocal tracks of some of his classic songs on YouTube. You can find them there. And everyone's always so astounded at his incredible musicality and inventiveness, even a cappella. So I think what the demos give us is both that sense of astonishment at his incredible talent, and also, you know, they are evidence. They are what solidifies the integrity of this project. Offering these originals assures us that what then we hear in the produced versions, in this case by Timbaland, are true to Michael's vision, and I think pretty much throughout the tracks are true to his vision.
So these are songs that Michael Jackson, for whatever reason, chose not to share with us. What's your philosophy about this kind of posthumous release? Should they have avoided digging into what might have been his rejection pile?
Well, sometimes I try to think in terms of 100 years from now, Tess. 100 years from now, anyone who's curious or eager to find out about Michael Jackson the way that, say, I might want to find out about a blues great like Bessie Smith, really should have as much information as they can. And the fact that Jackson decided not to release these on his albums during his life doesn't mean he didn't create them, and they can't tell us something about his vision. It's not just about making money. It certainly is about selling records, but it also is about giving us as much of one of the greatest musicians to ever live as we can have.
And certainly when you look back, you know, through music history, there are plenty of examples where some of the stuff that's released after an artist's death is the most well-known of their careers. I mean, you know, Sitting on the Dock of the Bay, Otis Redding, Me and Bobby McGee, Janis Joplin. Is there anything on this new Michael Jackson album that you think could have that kind of staying power?
I've thought a lot about that, Tess. As enjoyable as these songs are, you know, there's never going to be another Thriller. Michael's presence on the earth was what made him a star, you know, not just what he did in the studio. And that's gone, and we all have to deal with that. That doesn't mean we can't enjoy this gift that has been now given to us, or this product, which I consider a gift.
That's Ann Powers from NPR Music. Ann, thanks so much.
Thank you so much, Tess.
Time now for the latest installment of our series, My Big Break, about triumphs big and small. This next piece comes from listener Terry Boring, whose story does not echo his name. He wrote to us about his big break that started with a dead-end job at a convenience store in Pittsburgh.
I was the assistant manager, which, as some people may or may not know, is actually the worst job that you can have in the convenience store business, because you get none of the respect of the store manager. You get all of the terrible hours that they can't get anyone else to work. And the uniforms, it was like they got out of the time machine straight out of 1981. It's mint green, and I had these pleated black slacks. And I just looked like a sad joke. It was not a fun place to work. My big break happened one day when one of the regulars walked into the convenience store, and I later come to find out that his name was Greg. He bought his usual pack of Marlboro Lights, and I remember at the time we had a special going on where if you bought two packs of Marlboro cigarettes, it was $10 instead of the usual $6.50 per pack. I said, listen, you come in every couple of days, you buy a pack of cigarettes, you could buy two packs and save yourself some time and money. And he paused and smiled and looked at me, and he said, what are you doing here, kid? What are you doing working in a place like this? No one had ever asked me a question quite like that before. Up until that point, you know, I didn't do very well in school. Most of my young and early adult life had been spent with, you know, a lot of people telling me how much potential I was wasting and how I wasn't really living up to what I was capable of doing. So I didn't really have an answer for him, and I just said, I really don't know what else I would be doing. And he said, well, I work at a bank, and I work in sales. You should come work with me. I want you to apply for a job. I'll put in a good word for you. I went in, they interviewed me, and the recruiter called me back and said some words that I really wasn't expecting. We'd like to extend you an offer for a job. And by the way, this is not a glamorous job that I'm signing up for. It was the customer service representative job, which at the time I was ecstatic about. And I ran into Greg and I said, hey, I got the job. And he said, oh, congratulations, buddy. I just told him, yeah, thanks a lot for putting in a good word for me. And he said, oh, I totally forgot to. Sorry about that. And I had done it all on my own. The thing that I can kind of take away from that is it's really amazing what can happen when somebody believes in you, even if, you know, you don't believe in yourself. About 9 months later, I got a job in the sales department, and I became the top salesperson, and having set the annual and monthly record for sales in the department, they noticed me. And eventually I kind of worked my way up, and here I am 7 years later, a vice president of the company and sales performance manager. And my big break can be, you know, is found in a most unexpected place.
That's Terry Boring. He emailed us his story, and now we want to hear from you. Send us a message at mybigbreak@npr.org. When Hollywood needs a big dude, and I mean a really big dude, they can call on all sorts of former athletes, but they'd be hard-pressed to find many with the heart and humor of my next guest. Terry Crews has stolen quite a few scenes in movies like The Expendables and White Chicks. He was the dad on TV's Everybody Hates Chris, and he is currently a police sergeant on the Golden Globe-winning Brooklyn Nine-Nine. And maybe his most puzzling role? Those surreal ads for Old Spice from a couple of years ago.
Old Spice body spray will make you feel so powerful it'll blow your mind right in front of your face!
I still don't get those. Power! Anyway, the former NFL linebacker can now add author to his business card. Terry Crews has a new memoir coming out on Tuesday. It's called Manhood.
It's all about my journey into being a man. The book should have been called, you know, Terry Crews is an Idiot. And this is how I survived. I'm serious. There was so much astounding immaturity in this book. I have to say, I'm very ashamed of a lot of things that went down in my life. Like, I'm almost like, how did I make it out of that?
Your story starts in Flint, Michigan.
Mm-hmm.
Your father worked for the auto industry during this time of real sharp decline. And before work, he was all business. And after work, he was kind of an ugly drunk.
Yes.
What were the lessons about manhood that you were learning from your father at the time?
Wow. You know, my father was a hard worker. I mean, that was his thing. But also, he dealt with a lot of his past problems. You know, as an African American, there's a lot of things that culturally we just don't talk to each other. Anything bad in the past is supposed to be suppressed, and you know, somebody had it harder than you. So just be glad you're eating, you know, and that's the attitude. And then what would happen is he would bury all his problems in alcohol. But what happened is it would come out one way or the other. He abused my mother. There was a lot of physical violence in the home. My father was addicted to alcohol, and my mother was addicted to religion. We were in a denomination that didn't allow us to go to the movies. We couldn't dance. We couldn't play sports. My mother couldn't wear makeup. It was damn near Amish.
You know? You should have been in Footloose.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Right? Well, all those things I just mentioned, I ended up doing, except wearing makeup. But I do wear makeup on Brooklyn Nine-Nine,
right,
so it works
right
out. But it's kind of wild because I ended up in all those worlds.
Well, you got married pretty early in life to the single mother of a toddler.
Yes.
And, you know, as you mentioned, this was not your typical childhood where, you know, you'd go on dates. In fact, you didn't do that until your late teens.
Yep.
Seems like you jumped in the deep end of adulthood pretty quickly.
You know, getting married the day before my 21st birthday, everybody opposed it. They were like, you don't even know what's going on. You don't. I said, now I can be the hero. Because I always saw myself as a superhero. I was like, here's a single mom. And she was actually on welfare when I met her. And she had a baby who was only 6 months old when we met. And I was going to sweep her off her feet and take this family and do all these great things. And I will be her hero and the whole deal. But I didn't even know myself.
Mm.
I had no clue. And she suffered the brunt of a delayed adolescence. I was addicted to pornography at a very young age. So I would do that just in the cut, you know, even as I'm married, the whole thing. That cognitive dissonance thing's happening all the way. Oh, yeah, I'm good, and I go to church and all this stuff, but then I turn around, and I'm addicted to pornography at the same time. More stress.
Well, your ticket out of Flint was a full athletic scholarship. You ended up making it to the NFL, but you always had post-football life in the back of your mind. What did you think you would do?
No, when I met my wife, while we were dating, I told her that I was going to play in the NFL, and I was going to move to L.A., and we're going to make movies. That's exactly what I told her. I had a love affair with entertainment. That was another release thing for me, because once my I got a little bit older, my mother got a little looser on the movie thing. You know what I mean?
So you could go to the theater.
So, yeah, the first movie we ever got to see was The Apple Dumpling Gang, which, with Tim Conway and the whole thing. And then she let us graduate. We begged and begged and begged, and I got to see Star Wars. Changed my life. I told her, like, film is better than church because you get your morality from movies. You don't get it from church. I'm like, preacher's lying to me right here because I know what he's doing in, somewhere else. But the movies, it tells you what's right. The force is with you. This, you know, it's
what,
like,
what was the morality from the Apple Dumpling Gang?
Well, yeah. You know, I blanked it out real bad. Like, no. And I said, this is where I'm learning life. And I said, I got to be a part of this.
I'm speaking with actor Terry Crews about his new memoir, Manhood. We have an ongoing series on this show called My Big Break. And I wonder if you could tell us how your acting career got started. What was your big break?
Well, a friend of mine invited me to an audition. It was a TV show called Battle Dome, which was basically American Gladiator on steroids. Okay? They put me in a cage, light the end zone fire, and put me in with three contestants, and I was forced to battle my way out. We sent people to the hospital. I mean, every day someone was going straight to the hospital. It was a circus with human beings. I remember being an extra in Training Day, and I was the guy who, when Denzel's yelling at everybody in the neighborhood and King Kong ain't got nothing on me, I'm standing right there behind him. In the Oscar, when Denzel won the Oscar, it's me and Denzel on the screen. They showed his scene. If I never did anything after that, I was like, Mom, I was on the Oscars. I'm in the Academy Awards. My family flipped. They're like, you're on the Academy Awards.
And by that time, she's okay with the movie.
Yeah. Right? Yeah, she's good now. She's good. Everybody changed since then. Sure. You know?
So you've had all this really radical change in your professional life over the years. And you have been with your wife for, what, it must be 25?
It'll be 25 years in July.
How has that relationship changed through all this?
Wow. You know, the biggest change came on what I call D-Day, when I had to reveal my addiction to my wife. And it wasn't anything like I got caught.
Are you talking about your pornography addiction?
Yes, yeah. Yes. And it was like, she's like, something's weird. There's something you're not telling me. And I told her. I told her everything. And I remember she was like, that's it. I'm out. It's a wrap. Over. Peace. And I was like, oh, my God. This is the worst thing that could ever happen to me. And what was wild is that a little while later, she gave me another chance. She said, now that I know everything, I'm still choosing to love you. And I mean, let me tell you something. My marriage could have went either way. She was right to make any kind of decision she wanted. If she wanted to go, nope, I don't want any more, she was justified and right to do that. But she said, I'm going to love you. That kind of mercy, that kind of grace it took our relationship a whole nother level, because this is one thing I never realized and one thing I never thought. I always thought if she really knew who I was, she wouldn't want to be with me. And that blew my mind. You have to know everything about the other person. And if they still love you, that's all you can ask for.
Would it be fair to say that's the greatest lesson of manhood? Forgiveness?
That is the greatest lesson. Manhood used to be the Marlboro Man. My way. The highway. I walk alone. And the Marlboro Man is always by himself. Family, kids can't hang with him. They don't understand him. But what happens is that guy, in his 60s, he's back there in his shed and he's crying his eyes out. He's alone. No one wants to be with him. And I averted that future. And now I'm going a whole nother way. And my job is to tell other men and other women who deal with those kind of men how to understand themselves.
That's actor Terry Crews. His new memoir is called Manhood, How to Be a Better Man or Just Live with One. And by the way, announced this week that he is the new host of Who Wants to Be a Millionaire? Congratulations.
Thank you.
Hopefully you'll be a little less imposing than you were on Battle Dome.
Oh, no, there'll be more. No, there'll be explosions. There will be explosions if you don't get the answer right. I'm going to punch you if you don't get it right. No, I'm kidding. That won't happen. That's a joke. I love it.
Uncle. Terry Crews, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. Can we edit that out?
No, absolutely not.
I just said I'm going to punch the guest. I did. You're going to see the next thing. Terry Crews just fired from Who Wants to Be a Millionaire.
It's going to be a People magazine.
The only man who had the job for 10 days.
For the week ending May 18th, 2014, that's the podcast edition of All Things Considered from NPR West, the best of our programs from Saturday and Sunday. The production staff includes Phil Harrell, Tom Dreisbach, Becky Hersher, Priska Neely, Daniel Hajek, Becky Sullivan, and Alexis Kenyon. The technical director is Patrick Murray, with technical support from Leo Delagula and Marcia Caldwell. Mithoni Maturi is senior editor, and Steve Lichtai is our senior producer. I'm Tess Vigeland, in for Arun Roth. We'll be back next week, and remember, you can always hear the show on your local public radio station. Thanks for listening.